You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Obama places blame for the US's descent into some ugly politics on the media. We'll ask, are restricted resources in the press creating a dip in quality journalism? My guests, Jonathan Fenby and Kathleen Burke, will be answering this and more, including what might be on the table this Friday when the US president meets his Turkish counterpart, and how might Japan's revisions to its constitution affect its future military operations. We'll be looking at all of this, plus finding out how to buy a hotel. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guest today, Jonathan Fenby, who's the former editor of the South China Morning Post and who's now the managing director of the China team at Trusted Sources, and Kathleen Burke, professor of modern and contemporary history even at University College London and a regular columnist and also radio panelist. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start today's show in the US, where the race to decide the candidates for the upcoming election, namely from the Republican camp, has descended into something of a race to the bottom. Now, President Barack Obama has made some of his feelings known, but he's chosen to direct some of the blame for the more sensationalist stories emerging at journalists themselves. Speaking at an awards event last night, Obama referred to US politics as being untethered to reason and asked journalists to aim for higher aspirations. Jonathan, the speech is kind of amazing, and it does make you realise what a gear shift we potentially face in the coming months as Obama leaves the White House. You know, he was making a really heartfelt cry. He wasn't saying, normally when you hear politics talking about journalists, they're saying kind of, you know, leave us alone, back off a bit. He was saying the opposite. He was saying, we need to be scrutinised. You need to ask us the tough questions, and you've stopped doing that. What did you make of his speech?
Yes, I mean, he was saying, be more rigorous. You've let your standards slip, and so on. I think, on the other hand, what he was talking about was probably not, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post. He was talking more about the culture in which any kind of gossip, smear, innuendo, whatever it is, immediately goes viral and spreads around, which is a reflection, to me, more of the change in the whole media landscape than the fact that what I would call, you know, conventional or mainstream or old-fashioned journalists have actually let their standards slip.
Kathleen, I wonder whether, you know, we're seeing in the US, as in elsewhere, you know, the falling away of local newspapers, of, you know, state newspapers, and the dependency, you know, is, you know, on one or two outlets. So in if you're highbrow and you want to read the New York Times, sure, you'll get, you know, a good level of debate. But perhaps if you traditionally would have read a newspaper 20 years ago, now you're taking your news from radio or from TV, and there the world of the, you know, the shock jock and the explosive TV interview has become all important because it's all about clickbait. It's all about, you know, getting your numbers up all the time. Do you feel there has been a kind of a dislocation of quality and journalism in the US?
Well, I must say, if I can look a bit closer to home here, as it were, I would have been following just for fun. Well, not for fun, for obsessive necessity, what the BBC website over the past 6-9 months. And if you looked at how many times they had Donald Trump was doing, or videos of his talks and so forth, it's not just the so-called National Enquirer or supermarket special in the States that's doing that. It's also it was also the places like the BBC. Assessment that Trump has had $1.9 billion free dollars worth of media exposure just because of the journalists and photographers tracking him along. It is very difficult. I mean, if the important scene, you know, sort of serious newspapers have been falling by the wayside, they fall by the wayside because no one wants to read them. If no one wants to read them, is that difficult telling journalists they don't want to read you because you're too good? I mean, shall I go down to the bottom and say, this is democracy? You get what you get. And if you can't, and if somehow, the ability, and whether it's in schools or parents or I don't know, but if no one wants to read the serious papers, what are you going to do about it? You're going to say that the less serious papers, you'd better be a bit more serious because there's a gap in the public. I think it's a question that has many answers and no answers, and you can't. And if you can't really fault, of course you can. You can fault, but it's not surprising that if you live on rankings, you go down till you find the rankings.
Well, kind of, but I guess newspapers have always been a little bit dependent on rankings, even in the if there was a kind of glory day of newspapers. It's funny, I've been watching the Obama documentary, and you look at his first days in office, and he was quizzed and challenged on so many things. You wonder whether even there would be that kind of nature of engagement with the media, even with opposition people. Now it seems to be, it doesn't really matter whether Trump is telling the truth or not. He has a constituency. He plays to that constituency. And people don't want it to be questioned in a way, Jonathan.
Well, I've read quite a few analyses in papers like the New York Times, like the Washington Post and so on, of Trump taking him to bits in every way. But, you've got that on one side if you want it. But, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that, Trump is in many ways almost a godsend to the media because, as some television directors have said, you put him on and people are going to watch that, whereas they're not going to watch an earnest speech by one of the other candidates, if there are any earnest speeches by the other candidates. So, it's very, very difficult because if for the sake of argument, media did not report Trump, that is not reporting, choosing not to report, a very, very important political development in the United States. So you have to report it. The trouble is, are you doing it on his own terms? Yes, quite frankly, to some extent. And, I was in national newspapers here in Britain for a long time, and there's no doubt that somebody like Trump, that kind of flamboyant figure, or say Boris Johnson as mayor of London, they are, quote, good copy, unquote.
The other interesting thing, I guess, is when you look at this story, you do wonder, you're right about the BBC, because what's interesting is, I guess, everybody now wants their news to be bite-sized. They want it to be kind of a quick snack. So whether you're on the BBC or whether you're on any news website, you don't deliver something that's a 20,000-word read or a 2,000-word read or a 1,000-word read. Lo and behold, in 500, even on the BBC, you get down to 100 or 200 words. So everything is a headline. Everything is a kind of a shock value. And you're right. Every website seems to be addicted to its numbers. So you look on seemingly smart websites, but everyone's got a story about a cat and a boyfriend and a recipe on their homepage. And in the end, we've moved away from the idea of analysis, do you think?
Yes, and I think it's intensely depressing, I must say. I just found, I was a reader from first issue to last. In fact, Jonathan and I were on the same program when we discussed this before, the Independent newspaper. And I signed up to go and see what it was like online. And instead of having the long analytic stories I know and love, there was back to, if you printed out, a page and a half, and that was it. So even an outstanding newspaper, as I thought the Independent was, has had to cut its cloth, fit its cloth. And if even that does it, I find this is a very depressing conversation because it's hard to see what one can do about it.
I guess the positive is that there does seem to be a market for long form in places. So we know that New York Times is thriving and existing. We know that many newspapers are commissioning long pieces. But Jonathan, I know you wanted to just jump in on that point.
Well, since you hadn't mentioned it, the Independent, I was there on running the home news side when it launched. And looking back, the Independent was incredibly lucky. Perhaps we were absolutely brilliant, but we were also very lucky because we did decide there were some stories we wouldn't cover, such as royal stories. I'm dubbed as the man who decided not to cover royal stories. It wasn't actually me, but as department head, I'll take credit. We would devote a lot of space to either analysis or to features or sometimes to purely a bit of very good writing. and give that a huge, you know, the whole of page three in a way that is impossible now. And somehow that caught on at that point, partly because it was so different, partly because it was so different politically. But now I was told the other day that a poll, a survey, I don't know exactly of whom or where it was, revealed that 70% of people who use Facebook get their first information about a news break from Facebook. There. And this is completely uncontrolled. You know, it's anybody putting anything on they want. But an example of this, my son, who lives in Singapore, was here at the time of the Brussels attacks. And he got hit. The first we heard of that was indeed somebody sending something from the Singapore Straits Times website through Facebook to him and a lot of other people. One is in a completely different world.
And I think the interesting thing is, you know, the weekend, you know, the FT, it was just a one-page piece, but they pulled together all the events from Brussels and they delivered a narrative that took you from the beginning of the events to the end. And I think that that's what you miss when you're in this news cycle, because you have all these snippets. And I felt myself, I realized when I sat down and read it at the weekend, that the narrative, the twists and turns, they hadn't even, you know, and I'm somebody who's a bit of a news junkie, they hadn't settled in my mind the same way as suddenly when someone has a couple of thousand words. Then you begin to kind of question people, and then you have a more interesting debate. Well, that's me. We need to get back to our guests, because we're going to stay in the US now, because this week the US president will meet with his Turkish counterpart, Tayyip Erdogan, at a nuclear security summit in Washington. Well, that's what people think, although that hasn't quite been confirmed by the White House. Because the meeting is up in the air because the relations between the two seem to be a little bit frosty. Firstly, over events with ISIS, and also the recent record on press freedom in Turkey. Kathy, a meeting, should it happen? Would it be good if it happened?
Well, leaders use diplomatic meetings as carrots and sticks, of course. Erdogan has said there's going to be a one-to-one meeting with Obama. The White House, as you quite rightly point out, has not confirmed this. A one-to-one meeting could be a handshake and a hi, of course. So in that sense, one could do something on that order. But I think Obama, I mean, it's difficult. Obama wants to punish Turkey, obviously, because he's going down a road that none of us can like as we're seeing it. And, of course, the U.S. would not suffer in the same way as Europe would if Obama turned the spigot off on them, on taking the refugees. So the U.S. doesn't have as much to lose as Europe would if Merkel did it, for example. But I suspect that that Erdogan is going to be handled with kid gloves and is not going to get what he wants for domestic consumption.
Jonathan, potentially they may meet, they may not, you know, and we know that the US is certainly displeased with Erdogan, but it would be strange if, you know, they were not to have some kind of contact, especially after, you know, Obama's visit to Cuba, you know, visiting there, a government which is, you know, still no way near a democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, Turkey is much more of a democracy than Cuba. So it's likely there will be some engagement, don't you think?
I would think probably so. But also, you know, one has to put this in the broader context, the regional context there. And in this case, particularly the Kurds, whether Washington is still sees the Kurds as a partner, an ally in Syria. And that, of course, is always going to get Turkey's backup, you know, whether it's compatible to be partner with the Kurds in the one hand and have some kind of relationship with Ankara in the other. And then, of course, we've seen the deterioration in human rights, in press freedom, in general, the political context in Turkey, which has become more and more marked. Now, the European Union has shown that this doesn't really matter to it when it had the refugee crisis to deal with. As Kathy said, there's not the similar kind of pressure on Obama. So, yes, he probably should meet, but do so in a fairly restrained arm's length way.
No big kisses.
No big kisses, you know.
I mean, it's a problem. Think what Obama said about Erdogan, you know, in the Atlantic article that's coming up. He's pretty, I mean, in diplomatic terms, he's pretty harsh.
Yeah.
So does Erdogan, does he want to actually say, I mean, that could be interpreted as being smarmy or Do you see what I mean? That, you know, still, even though Obama says such appalling things about him, he still wants him. It's a very complicated arrangement. It really is.
Or do I, as Turkish leader of Turkey, get credit domestically by standing up to the Americans?
And shaking his hand.
And shaking his hand, but keeping my my mouth firmly away from a smile.
But interesting, I guess that both could get something out of this. You know, Erdogan has, you know, in many ways been a failure of late on the international stage, because, you know, he had this policy of, you know, being friends with all his neighbours. He played his cards in a complicated way against Syria. He seems to have had allegedly some kind of, you know, slowness in dealing with ISIS, let's put it like that. He's fallen out with Russia. So he would like to get back onto a better footing with the outside world in some senses, you know, and he's standing at home is middling. And for Obama, I guess, you know, he's got quite a powerful hand to play, because, as you say, Cathy, he doesn't really care that much. It's not going to affect him hugely. And also because if the Syrian war is now turning the way of the Assad regime, Turkey is going to be less important in the outcome, in a sense, don't you think?
Turkey has made it. Erdogan came to power assuming he was going to, or intending to make Turkey the great regional power. And he has made such a series of misjudgments, one after the other, that you have to wonder about what will happen. Yes, if Syria settles down, which Turkey doesn't want, there will be problems. If Syria settles down, leaving the Kurds on the Turkish border, there will be even more interesting problems. So Turkey has come out of this with no advantages, I don't think, and has accumulated quite a few disadvantages.
And Cathy, you know, just as you know, we're looking ahead to an election, what's your kind of take on Obama's foreign policy of late, in the last year or so? He's, you know, it's interesting, when you come to the tail end of your administration, you'd feel that you would be really kind of shutting down on some of those things and waiting to pass it on. But he seems, you know, oddly quite engaged with a lot of final manoeuvres. You know, we saw Cuba. You know, he does seem to have a kind of tougher stance against Turkey. Do you think that he is engaged in the right way? You know, many people have been disappointed with his foreign policy, but what's your take on recent manoeuvres?
Well, it seems to me that in fact, for the past year or two, and it can't be just me who's noticed that he's sort of flung off the fetters and done various sorts of things that he's wanted to do and has felt unable to do. He doesn't have anything to lose anymore. His reputation, his legacy, as they say, is improving. And the things he will leave having put in place, solidified Obamacare, put forth a Supreme Court justice nominee, which may actually get through, inching its way there. Cuba, done more on Guantanamo. He has done this in a way that's not exactly insouciant, but shows that he doesn't care. And he's not being indifferent, doesn't care, but this is what he's going to say, and no one can do anything about it now.
And Jonathan, just on the, you know, many parts of the world, but even in you know, when it comes to foreign policy with China, you know, he's kind of like not backed down over the disputes in the, you know, in the Pacific. He seems to be robust there as well. What's your take on his actions?
I wouldn't quite say that. I think he's, you know, he's played it as softly as possible with China, and certainly, you know, people who are in the know in Washington say that the State Department, Commerce Department, others wanted a much tougher line with China, and the line from the White House has always been, I want to get out of this without a blow up with China there. But I would say, I mean, if I was a foreign leader, I would think, looking at the election, hey, you know, it may be my interest to make a deal under Obama, because whoever comes after him is going to be much more difficult to deal with.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, and my guests Kathleen Burke and Jonathan Fenby. Coming up next, we assess what the future holds for Japan's military.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed, because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Jonathan Fenby and Kathleen Burke. In Japan, new national security laws come into force today. In effect, they loosen the limits of the country's pacifist constitution, allowing it to have a more active role in military operations overseas, the first time since the Second World War. The Japanese public remains divided over whether this change is necessary or indeed wise. However, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has said that the new legislation is vital to meet new challenges such as China's activities in the South China Sea. Jonathan, we were just talking about this very topic. Now, you know, it's interesting, you, again, we hear the candidates, like Trump thing, saying Japan just doesn't do enough in the region, they should be shouldering the burden more, and here is Japan inching its way towards doing that. Is this an important moment, do you think?
I think it's important. There's an important process that's been going on for several years. I mean, Abe has made the undemilitarization, if I can put it that way, because I don't want to say the remilitarization of Japan, one of his priorities. And, you know, it comes from his family, from his whole background, from quite a strong wing in his party and indeed in his cabinet. As has been the case elsewhere in Asia, in East Asia, China, by asserting itself, by going out, by claiming sovereignty over the Senkaku Daiyu Islands, for instance, as over the South China Sea, has actually emboldened those who want to take a tougher and stronger military line. I mean, Xi Jinping and Abe are, there must be some phrase for this in political theory, they are objective allies who pretend to be opponents. And I think there's something in game theory, again, where, you know, we always think there must be a solution to a problem and people will want to find a solution. In this case, I don't think either Abe or Xi have any desire at all for things to calm down because it suits them for their nationalist domestic agenda.
Does that, just as a quick question, if I may, does that mean objective allies, that they unite together to crush all the other...
the anti-American, yes, if Mr. Trump comes in, who knows?
No, I'm thinking of Vietnam and Philippines and Malaysia.
But it's interesting, sorry not to go in, you were saying Trump, you know, Japan should do more. We hear this often, we heard this about Germany a lot in the past. Germany should play a stronger, higher level political role in Europe. And when Merkel started doing that, everybody started complaining, of course. And I wonder, you know, I've heard on the other hand from US military sources above all, that they are quite worried that the Japanese are going to, you know, it's going to run away with things in Japan. I think the break on this is, as you referred to, the fact that an awful lot of Japanese people and public opinion is pretty leery of going back into a military stance.
When you go to Japan, you see, you know, the nationalist floats running around town shouting, you know, that they want to be remilitarized and take back land, but they have a very small minority. The silent majority seem to be very concerned about going back to a point where they remilitarize. But on the point that Kathy raised, it is interesting, you know, that, you know, Japan has made good connections with, oddly, with Vietnam. The US have got a base back in Palawan in the Philippines. The checks and balances do seem to be altering.
Yeah, Abe has certainly been going out. I mean, it's both military arrangements, you know, joint maritime exercises in the South China Sea with the Philippines and others, Vietnam, as you've mentioned. But it's also economic, that while China has been offering a lot of aid for infrastructure projects, Japan has been up there too with its checkbook. And you see that all through East Asia.
Well, we're going to finish today with a story, which was a business story, which is about the world of the fluffy pillows, because US hotel group Marriott International is currently battling a consortium led by China's Ong Bang Insurance Group to buy the Starwood Group of hotels, which includes the W and Sheraton hotel brands. Anbang has come in with a hefty $14 billion offer, with Marriott sticking around $13.5 billion. But does an insurance firm such as Anbang have the expertise or experience to run a hotel group of this size? Kathy, was it, I guess, the whole thing about this is what we're fascinated is about the money that's coming out of China at a time when the economy is a bit slower, just to buy things up, you know, to invest overseas. And many people are saying this is a bit like, the again, going back to Japan in the 80s, when people went abroad and bought up all sorts of things that they didn't actually know how to run or what to do with, and it all went horribly wrong. When you see these mega deals by unknown insurance companies, do you think that they're a sign of good things or, again, a sign of potentially overreach?
Well, China is in a particular situation there. Most insurance companies want predictable income because they have to pay off premiums. And so they buy fixed interest securities, knowing they're going to get this much, this much, this much, this much at predictable times. Now, this is a huge insurance company. Now, it says, for example, it's got this huge aging population and it needs, you know, it needs the money. So therefore, it can't just go for that. It has to go for more the more exciting sorts of things, equities or hotels. And also, they want to get their money out. RMB is going to devalue a bit. Take the money out now. Use it out because you may not longer have the control. And also, the idea that a real grown-up conglomerate tends to have interests in all sorts of areas. Just an insurance company is no longer very, is no longer so obvious. And so, if it's going also for not notoriety, but fame and as a big Chinese company, it's not surprising, except that fluffy pillows. Yeah, who's going to run the thing?
Jonathan, what do you make? It's interesting, I guess, when you look around London, many of the buildings we look at, you know, they just, you imagine they're all owned by some boring company, and it turns out they're owned by, you know, a pension fund from Canada, or they're owned by some trade union in the background. There's always odd owners who, perhaps in the end of it, don't get too involved with the running of the business. But what do you make of this deal?
Well, I think, as Kathy said, this is part of China going out, as it were, and it takes all kinds of forms. It's obviously got Xi Jinping's backing. He made, 14 foreign visits last year. He's putting himself about.
You're saying he wants somewhere to sleep when he goes.
Well, he wants somewhere to sleep, yeah. No, he'd prefer to stay at Buckingham Palace, I think. He wants China to be much more of a presence throughout the world. And, of course, you know, savvy business people pick this up and say, we're just doing the leader's teachings and we're going abroad. But I think there are lots of other elements in this, including, undoubtedly, the desire. I wouldn't say so much to move your money out of China for the sake of it, because actually the renminbi has stabilized recently, and who knows what the long term, it's not going to devalue. There'll be a deterioration probably in its value slightly. It depends on what the dollar does, very largely. But there's a desire to be present more, to spread your assets more widely. The question is, going back to China, is how they're going to finance this, because is this just yet more debt? And China's debt level, corporate debt level, is already very high indeed. It's likely to go up even more under the new five-year plan, because people will have to borrow yet more money just to keep going and service their existing debts. The government, to keep up growth, is now easing up on credit. It's much easier to get credit. Anbang it's rather opaque, the ownership, but it certainly has good political links with the Communist Party establishment. And they all say, we're China's Warren Buffett. That's the idea. You go out and buy assets all over the place.
Except that there's also the argument they've gone too far.
Exactly.
And the regulators aren't going to let them do it.
Yeah. Well, the regulator, a Chinese insurance company can only have 15% of its assets outside the People's
country.
Republic, and they may fall foul of that unless they find a way around it. And then at home, what they're doing, they're part of a process whereby, without going into all the complications of it, the Chinese government is trying to move the debt, huge debt levels, away from the banks and into basically households. So households will buy the debt in one form or other. And the insurance, selling insurance policies, is a major element in that. So, you know, this is fairly thin ice stuff we're in here.
And in 5 years' time, there'll be an incredible Chinese debt crisis.
Yes.
Well, we'll see what happens with the deal. There's no announcement yet, and it may still be that they don't kind of win it in the end. But we're going to have to leave it there for today. My guests, Jonathan Themby and Kathleen Burke, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Charlie Young, and also by Ilse Viveros. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Josh Fennett. And we'll have more on the day stories at the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.